Hello everybody, I'm George from Ireland, so thanks for coming to my channel. We're telling you about Lord Cecil of Chelwood. So he was best known for being really the mastermind behind the League of Nations, an enthusiast for that, a politician, someone who worked for the Pacific Settlement of International Disputes. So he was born in London in Cavendish Square, just a couple of miles west of here, and his father was the third Marquess of Salisbury, who later was thrice Prime Minister, was a Conservative. His father was sort of rather reactionary, but went along with certain reformers because that was the only way to win and hold power, was an ardent imperialist. So the Cecils have been a prominent noble family since the reign of Elizabeth I. But our Viscount Cecil of Chelwood, his mother came from a wealthy Scots family, so it's mostly English, partly Scots. And the Gascoigne Cecils, some people say it's really pronounced Cecil rather than Cecil, if you're posh. They obviously had distant ancestors from southwest France, hence the surname Gascoigne. Anyway, he was educated by private tutors, and then he went to Eton at 13. He spent 3 years there. He wasn't particularly into games. And then, unusually, he went on to University College Oxford, because Etonians who went to Oxford those days mostly went to Christchurch, which was the grandest, most aristocratic college, somewhere onto Balliol. So Uni was unusual, but not unheard of. There are 39 colleges of Oxford University these days. Back then, there were only about 20. A few went to Magdalen. Anyhow, so he graduated from there. And more unusually, from a man who was a nobleman, he decided to read for the bar. So he was indeed called to the bar, and he practiced as a chancery barrister for quite a few years. But that's about the only profession which was considered acceptable for an upper-class man. Being an army officer, a clergy, that was it. I mean, possibly, you know, obviously in the colonial administration. Not that he really needed the money, but he wanted to achieve something. So he married Eleanor, Lord Lambton's daughter. I'm not sure if they were blessed with children, but in those days, people almost always did. I mean, the 19th century, six children was the average. They rarely all made it. Anyway, so he acted as private secretary to his father. He was brought up in a Christian family, unsurprisingly, of the Anglican stripe. And he had this passionate faith, but that led him to want peace. So he was in the Unionist Party. He was definitely opposed to Home Rule for Ireland. But this was abnormal for a unionist. He supported free trade. He didn't want imperial preference. He wanted to keep prices low, like the Liberal Party did. Anyway, he was eventually elected MP for Hitchin, which is in Hertfordshire. And of course, there the family seat was their Hatfield House, so in Hertfordshire, not too far away. Remember, his grandfather's the one who had the capital of what's now Zimbabwe named in honour of him, Salisbury. Now it's Harare. Back those days, that country was called Rhodesia. Anyway, our Viscount Cecil, in the First World War, he continued to serve in the cabinet as an undersecretary for foreign affairs, but he was aghast at the war, at all the senseless loss of young life, all the impoverishment, all the agony it was inflicting on people, and thought there has got to be a better way to deal with these international disagreements. So he wrote various memoranda during the war about how there could be some international organization which could deal with these international disputes and arrive in agreement without a single drop of blood being spilt. Because, you know, you fight about it, doesn't mean the righteous side necessarily wins. And even if the righteous side does win, it's sometimes not worth it in terms of the number of lives lost. One war starts seven more. It's very easy to start, very difficult to stop. And eventually his ideas were accepted, and he recognised the cruciality of bringing the United States in. So after the war, he began to campaign for this. He was troubled that many in the Republican Party in the USA were opposed, feeling it intruded upon their independence. He said, OK, we'll accept the Monroe Doctrine. No foreign country will have any involvement in the American continent beyond what they have already. I thought that was a necessary concession. I mean, President Roosevelt signed the Treaty of Versailles, which included the establishment of the League of Nations, but ultimately the US Congress voted not to join, partly because of Senator Cabot Lodge's famous oration, "An American I was born." And so it went on like that, listened to in stock silence, in which he adumbrated his reasons for opposition to American membership of the newly founded League of Nations. Viscount Cecil, he was sat in the United Nations. Bizarrely, he represented South Africa. I'm not sure if he ever even visited that country. And he was instrumental in the establishment of the League of Nations Union, trying to get ordinary men and women to be enthusiasts for it, to disseminate knowledge of the League of Nations, for it would confer greater legitimacy on it. But alas and alack, it was not to be. So he was Chancellor, Duchy of Lancaster, and Stanley Baldwin, Baldwin's government in the mid-1920s. He did hold another cabinet post. I don't remember what it is. But it broke his heart to see the League of Nations failing. And he was a believer in appeasement, that maybe small concessions to the likes of Mussolini were a price well worth paying for avoiding a war. And he was said this war, a new war, was sure to kill many millions more than we killed in the First World War, to date the bloodiest war in human history. These people were not cowards, some of those appeasers. They fought in the First World War. They knew what war was, and they knew it really has to be a last resort, and you should do anything and everything to avoid it. And even giving some Britannic territory in Africa to Italy to appease them rather than them have them start this war against Abyssinia was worth it. In the end, it wasn't to be. So he lived on until the age of 94, an extraordinarily great age. He was speaking in the House of Lords regularly into the 1950s. Alec Douglas Hume, a later Conservative Prime Minister, held him in high regard. He died at Danes Hill, which is in Surrey, a bit southwest of London, on the way to Guildford of Clandon in his house. I'm not sure where he's laid to rest. So Philip Noel Baker lived at the same house as him, who was an Olympian and also an Old Etonian, but I think he's in another video. Anyway, thanks very much for watching my this. Make sure you subscribe on Patreon. Donate PayPal, George Callahan 79@gmail.com. Toodle pip.